Chapter 39. Justice for Sergei. Marcel told me that Perepelichny had dropped dead in front of his house in Surrey during an afternoon jog, but that he had no other information. It took several minutes for this news to sink in. Surrey was not more than 20 miles from where I sat. If this was foul play, which it appeared to be, then our enemies had brought their terror to us. Marcel's request to keep this to myself was totally unreasonable, and I immediately pulled Vadim, Vladimir, and Ivan into my office. I told them the bad news, and they were utterly shocked, especially Vadim and Vladimir, both of whom had gotten to know Perepelichny well in the last year. As we spoke, Vladimir dropped into a chair and said something quietly to himself in Russian that I couldn't understand. Just as we were talking, the Hermitage staff erupted in cheers, and I saw them high-fiving outside the glass walls of my office. I opened my door and asked what was going on. My secretary turned to me and said, "The Magnitsky Act just passed the House 365-43. This was huge news, but I wasn't in a state of mind to celebrate. Another person connected to this case had just died. I tried to bottle up my feelings about Perepelichny as best I could and joined the team to congratulate them on their hard work. I spent a few minutes talking about the vote and the next steps, but I didn't want to tell them about Perepelichny until I could digest the implications. I returned to my office to sit at my desk and think. I put my head in my hands and tried to make sense of what I had just learned. Was Perepelichny murdered? Were his killers still in the United Kingdom? Were they going to come after us? I wanted to start making calls to people who could help me figure all these things out, but I couldn't. I had to be at the new Diorama Theater in 45 minutes to host the play about Sergei that was taking place that night. I went to the theater and attempted to push all my dark thoughts to the back of my mind. I made my way into the lobby, passing the brightest stars of London's human rights community, MPs, government officials, celebrities, artists, as well as close friends. We all took our seats and watched. The play was moving and powerful, and when it was over, three special guests and I carried folding seats onto the stage and began a panel discussion. The panel consisted of Tom Stoppard, the famous playwright, Vladimir Bukovsky, a former Russian political prisoner, and Bianca Jagger, Mick Jagger's ex-wife and a respected human rights activist. Stoppard and Bukovsky shared their story about how Stoppard had written a play in the 1970s that helped free Bukovsky from a Soviet psychiatric prison. Using Sergei's story, they pointed out that after all this time, almost nothing had changed in Russia. Speaking last, I said to the audience, "Indeed, the situation in Russia is dire, but today there is one small ray of light. Just a few hours ago, the U.S. House of Representatives voted on the Sergei Magnitsky Rule of Law Accountability Act to sanction the people who tortured and killed him. I'm proud to say that the bill passed with 89% of the votes." I'd planned to say more, but was cut off by an outburst of applause. One by one, people rose from their seats, and before I knew it, everyone was standing. They were applauding the campaign, but more than that, they were applauding this tiny bit of justice in the world. I couldn't help but be moved, and I stood and started clapping too, along with everyone else. I shook hands and accepted congratulations as I made my way out of the theater, but all I could think of was getting home. I told Elena about Perepelichny on my way to the play, and more than anything, I needed to talk to her. When I got home, I found Elena sitting on the couch, staring blankly at the living room wall. It is never good to see terror in the face of one you love, but that was exactly what I witnessed in Elena that night. We were home, our children were asleep, and we were theoretically safe. but I was sure that Parapolichny had thought the same at his house in Surrey. The next morning, I spoke to my London lawyer, Mary, and we agreed that we should alert the Surrey police as soon as possible. They had to understand that this case involved high-level Russian corruption and organized crime. Parapolichny wasn't someone who just dropped dead. Mary drafted a letter, stressing that Parapolichny was a cooperating witness in a major money laundering case and might have been poisoned, as Alexander Litvinenko had been in 2006. She urged the police to do a toxicology analysis as soon as possible. Mary faxed the letter on Saturday, heard nothing on Sunday, and followed up on Monday with a call to the Weybridge police station. The duty officer confirmed that they'd received her letter, but strangely told her they had no record of any death involving someone named Parapolichny. I thought that was absurd, and asked Mary to get someone more senior who knew what was going on. She made more calls, and this time the police confirmed that Parapolichny had in fact died on November 11th on the private road near his house, but they were unwilling to discuss any other details. Mary pointed out that we had information that could be helpful to their investigation, but the police simply took her number and said that they would get back to us if they needed to. By Wednesday, the police still hadn't contacted Mary. That day, I heard from Marcel that the initial post-mortem results for Parapolichny came back inconclusive. The coroner couldn't determine a cause of death. No heart attack, no stroke, no aneurysm. Parapolichny had just died. This was worrying for one reason in particular. Just before his death, Parapolichny had told us that he was on a Russian hit list and had been receiving death threats, making it reasonably likely that a Russian assassin was on the loose in the UK. If he'd gotten to Parapolichny, then he could just as easily get to us. Mary hounded the police for the rest of the week, but was continually rebuffed. I was so upset by the following Monday that I asked her what we could do to get them to act. Her advice was simple: go to the press. Normally, lawyers advise you to stay away from the press in these situations, but it was such a matter of public interest, and the police were being so unresponsive, that in her opinion, we didn't have any other choice. That day, I got in touch with an investigative journalist at London's independent newspaper and told him the whole story. I provided him with the documentation that Parapolichny had given us and a list of phone numbers that he could use to verify different parts of the story. 2 days later, the Independent ran a story with the headline, "Supergrass Who Held Key to Huge Russian Fraud Is Found Dead in Surrey." Supergrass is British slang for informant. Parapolichny's face covered the entire front page of the newspaper. Inside were a further 5 full pages describing every part of the story. The story ricocheted between every television station, radio show, and newspaper in the United Kingdom. Everyone was terrified that Russian organized criminals were settling scores on the streets of London. Immediately after these stories came out, the Surrey police finally sent 2 homicide detectives to our office to interview us. Then, 21 days after Parapolichny died, the police announced they would do a full toxicology analysis on his corpse. In my mind, this came way too late. If he'd been poisoned, by now it could be undetectable. With a major homicide investigation underway, and the press all over the case, whoever did this to Parapolichny would have been spooked and surely gone to ground. While the threat level was still high, I was no longer in a state of absolute panic and felt comfortable enough to refocus on my responsibilities. The Senate vote in Washington was now only days away. While I couldn't be there to witness it, I was going to be in the United States to give a speech at Harvard and to have some meetings in New York. I flew to Boston on Sunday, December 2nd, and when I got off the plane, An urgent message from Kyle was on my BlackBerry. I called him as I walked toward immigration.
"Hey, Bill, what's up?"
he said, just as always. "I got your message. Is there something wrong?"
"Possibly. There are a number of senators who are insisting on keeping Magnitsky global instead of Russia only."
"What does that mean for us?"
"Well, it's not just Cardin anymore. There's a growing group of senators led by Kyle and Levin who are also insisting on the global version."
"But I thought the whole Senate was behind it."
"There's no question that we have the votes, Bill. But if there's no consensus on which version to put up, Harry Reid won't schedule a vote,"
Kyle said, referring to the Senate Majority Leader.
"And the clock's ticking."
"Is there anything I can do?"
"Yeah. Try to contact Kyle's and Levin's people and give them your arguments for why they should go with the Russia-only version. I'll try the same with Cardin."
"Okay. I'm stuck in Boston and New York for the next few days, but I'll do it." I stopped in the hallway before reaching immigration and spoke with Juliana. She wasn't as concerned as Kyle, but promised to get in touch with the senator's foreign policy staffs first thing Monday morning. I cleared customs and immigration and went to my hotel. The next morning, I went to the Harvard Business School to present a case study that the school had written about my experiences in Russia. For the first half of the class, the students took turns telling the professor what they would have done if they had been in my shoes. I sat in the back row, quietly watching as they came up with some good ideas that I wish I'd thought of. The case study brought them only to the point where our offices were raided in 2007, so they were thinking only about portfolio management and shareholder activism, not any of the criminal justice issues. Unless they were following the news, they didn't have any idea what had happened after. I took the podium for the second half of the class and told the whole story of the fraud and Sergei's arrest, torture, and death. The mood in the room changed as I spoke. By the end, I noticed that some of the students were crying. The professor, Aldo Musacchio, walked me out of the building afterward and told me that was the first time in his career at Harvard Business School that he'd ever seen students cry after a case study. I finished my visit to Harvard and made my way to New York. By the end of the next day, and in spite of Juliana's and Kyle's efforts, nothing in Washington had changed. Levin was immovable, and Cardin wasn't showing his hand. I went to sleep early on the night of December 4th, but woke up at 2 a.m. because of jet lag and all the 11th-hour uncertainty surrounding the Senate. I knew I wouldn't be able to go back to sleep, so I took a shower, put on the hotel robe, then sat at my laptop and searched for Magnitsky. One of the first things to come up was a press release from Senator Cardin's office. It had been posted late the night before. I clicked on the link and read it. Cardin had compromised. He had dropped his demand for global. I cleared my calendar for Thursday, December 6th, and brought up C-SPAN on my computer. I sat in my hotel room alone, waiting, pacing, and ordering room service. Finally, around noon, the Senate voted on the Magnitsky Act. It all happened quickly. After half the votes were tallied, it was certain that the bill would pass. The final count was 92-4. Levin and three other senators were the only ones to vote against it. It was almost anticlimactic. There were no fireworks, no marching band, just a roll call, and then on to the next piece of business. But the implications were enormous. Since 2009, 13,195 bills had been written, and only 386 had made it out of committee and been enacted. We had defied the odds. We had done so because of Sergei's bravery, Natalia's heart, Kyle's commitment, Cardin's leadership, McCain's integrity, McGovern's foresight, Vadim's brilliance, Vladimir's wisdom, Juliana's savvy, and Elena's love. It had happened because of Ivan and Jonathan and Jamie and Eduard and Perepolichny and countless others, big and small. Somehow our little idea of sanctioning those who'd killed Sergei had taken root and grown. There was something almost biblical about Sergei's story. And even though I am not a religious man, as I sat there watching history unfold, I couldn't help but feel that maybe God had intervened in this case. There is no shortage of suffering in this world, but somehow Sergei's tragedy resonated and cut through, as few tragedies ever do. More than anything else, I wished that none of this had ever happened. More than anything else, I wished that Sergei were still alive. But he wasn't, and nothing could bring him back. Nevertheless, his sacrifice was not in vain. It pricked the bubble of impunity that ensnares modern Russia, leaving a legacy that he and his family could be proud of.